I wanted to pinpoint that moment where humanity was okay and comfortable with being naked.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Ravencast,
where we talk about mimetic theory. What is mimetic theory, Matt and Danielle? No, we're going to talk about that a little later. You don't have to do that right now.
I don't know. No.
I don't think Matt knows. No.
What are you doing on the show, Matt? We talk about mimetic theory and the violence and conflict and rivalry. That's it. Insights into those concepts that so often plague our world, our relationships, our marriages, our neighborhoods, and our world. And today I am so excited because we have two special guests on the show today, Danielle Kingstrom and Matt DiStefano. Hi, friends. How are you?
Good. Hello. Hi.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
Good, Adam. How are you? Thanks for having me on here.
Matt has been on the show a couple of times. This is the first time that Matt has come on with such fantastic hair. I love what you're doing with it.
I'm really doing nothing. I wake up and I show up.
What kind of shampoo do you use?
I don't know. Whatever's on sale at Grocery Outlet, Bargain Market.
Oh, that's fantastic. I need to go get some of that. It's great stuff. So I'm just going to introduce Matt and Danielle, and then we're going to get into a book that they are working on together, tentatively titled Naked and Known. And I know, right? And when I heard this, Danielle told me this last 2 weeks ago when I was talking with Suzanne Ross about her book on love and mimetic theory. And Danielle said, hey, I'm writing a book with Matt on Naked and Known. And I was like, let's do that. Let's talk about that. Yes, that sounds awesome. So Matt is the author of multiple books. First, All Set Free. I've got it here. Yep. And From the Blood of Abel, Humanity's Root Causes of Violence and the Bible's Theological Anthropological Solution. That's fun. And Matt, your latest book is here called Heretic. I love that. And hey, yeah, it's good. And it's a perfect cocktail of disgusting lies by Anonymous.
It is indeed. Yes,
Anonymous. That's what I've heard. Yeah. Anonymous says that, and we are no match for this professor of word vomit. You got your PhD in word vomit. Nicely done.
I did. Yeah, I got that a couple of years back. It was a tough process, but I'm glad I went through it.
Yeah, 4 years for that one, right? Yeah, some kind of dissertation on that one. That's good stuff. So Word Vomit, who in reality is getting 90% of his info from Wikipedia.
Wikipedia? It's like 85.
85? Okay. Yeah, or a bitter rabbi. There are a few of those around, I guess.
Rabbis
are always really cool, actually. I like rabbis.
I know. I didn't like the anti-Semitism behind that one. But,
no, that was not cool. So anyway, get the book Heretic because it's fantastic. And Matt is also on the Heretic Happy Hour, a fantastic podcast. And Danielle is also very active on, there it is. You can buy a cup, a mug of the Heretic Happy Hour.
And we have shirts.
Yes, you both have the new version of the Christian God loves gays, and I'm wearing the older version, which is Christian and affirming. So Matt made both of these shirts, right, Matt?
No, Rafael Palendo of Choir did the ones Danielle and myself are wearing, and I had a buddy who helped me with that one.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. So yeah. Where can they get the shirts? Cause this shirt is like more, is just, it's important now.
It's always been important, but right now, especially, if you go to heretichappyhour.com/store, all of our shirts are on there. Yeah.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah.
And coffee cups and pillows.
Yeah. And we have some hilarious pillows, man.
All kinds of great Heretic stuff. How Danielle is a writer, podcaster, and homeschool teacher. She lives in rural Minnesota on a farm with her husband and five children. I have three.
Yeah. Well, five is no different than three, trust me.
I've got one.
You're always playing catch up, huh? That's yes. Together, they maintain a fourth-generation legacy farm. that's a lot of generations. Nicely done.
Yes, there. It is. Yes. Yes. His family. Yeah. Came from Sweden straight here.
Oh, wow.
Set up shop and stayed around and popped out more generations. So taking that over.
Nicely done. Awesome. Danielle is unafraid to spark controversy. She's a frequent published author, appearing regularly in her community's local newspaper, writing about provocative issues and asking challenging questions. She is currently the co-host of Bookish with Michelle Collins and is working on her first book with Matt, Naked and Known. Danielle, before we get to Naked and Known, can you tell us a little bit about Bookish?
Bookish is Queer Second Podcast, and I will be hosting it with Michelle Collins. We're both fans of the Heretic Happy Hour and kind of socialize in the same circles in social media world. And so we both have a love affair with books. We're constantly reading all the time, challenging ourselves, looking into new concepts. And Raphael decided that it might make some kind of a unique podcast where we sit down and converse about the concepts we're reading within the books we're reading and just share those discussions with listeners and kind of help provoke others to start thinking outside the box. So that starts, we drop next week, our intro hits tomorrow, and then next week we drop our first three episodes, and we're really excited. They actually will drop on Women's Day, so March 8th. And yeah, we've done some really interesting books so far, and it's been actually kind of cool how we both came up with our own master book list of the books that we'd be interested in discussing, and somehow the synchronicity just lined up, and all of our all of our choices have just kind of piggybacked off of each other or kind of directly butted heads with one another. So that made it really interesting for the last three recordings we've done.
What books are you starting off with?
The first book I started off with is Shameless by Nadia Bolz-Weber. Nice. And then 12 Rules for Life by Mr. Jordan Peterson. And then the last book I just reviewed was A Mating in Captivity by Esther Perel. And she is kind of like a source that I've been using for the book me and Matthew are working on. She's got 40 years in the business. You could call her a sexpert. And so just a lot of what she said, I wanted to kind of pump out there just to kind of tease a little bit of what me and Matthew will be discussing in our book, Naked and Known.
Well, let's get into Naked and Known. This is the tentative title for a book. Do you have a date or an expected date for when the book will come out?
Okay. I think we've settled on that title. So the subtitle's tentative. We haven't got that far yet, but I think we're pretty set on Naked and Known. Okay. And as far as like a tentative date, we're just in the middle of writing the first draft of the manuscript, and we're about, I don't know, 30 some odd thousand words in. So we've got a ways to go. I'm going to guess it's going to be out in 2020, but you know, that's just a really tentative shot in the dark guess.
Awesome. And Naked and Known gives us some idea of what you might be talking about. How did you come up with the title?
Well, the theme that we're kind of bouncing off is just this whole nakedness, this vulnerability, and kind of stripping our layers down of like the masks we wear and the roles we take on. And Naked just kind of fit, especially since we knew we wanted to talk about sex and we wanted to talk about intimacy. And yeah, it's just been a penetrating theme throughout the book.
Okay. Yeah.
What say you, Mr. DiStefano?
I think you summed it up right. I think I like the sort of like double entendre that we're using, because we are going to talk about literal nakedness and figurative, or maybe more psychological or spiritual nakedness. And yeah, like Danielle said, stripping the layers back and approaching our long-term committed relationships a lot more vulnerably. I think vulnerability is something we lack, especially maybe in a social media world. I mean, we see it the most on social media, where we put up a front and we have a social media persona, and then we have our day-to-day real life persona. And I think I don't think that's new. I just think it's exacerbated with technology maybe. But I think we also do it with our relationships, you know, in real time as well. And so, yeah, one of our goals is to get people to be vulnerable with their, in their relationships, which goes along. I mean, you have to, you know, you can't condemn each other. You can't judge each other. You know, there has to be this, this safe space to be vulnerable.
We've got some audience members, and you can write comments or questions, and I will bring those in. I guess my first question is why is it important to be vulnerable? I mean, I don't want to be vulnerable, because when I'm vulnerable, it leaves me to being hurt. So why should I be vulnerable?
Daniel, I'm going to let you take it. And then I'll explain what you're trying to say.
So Brené Brown
speaks
to shame a lot. And Matt and I are both fans of her as well. And what does she say? The antidote to shame is vulnerability, is that authenticity is being real. And vulnerability is what connected me and Matthew, actually, in a writing piece. And so we both saw that that was very important, just because maybe as he has done and I have done, as you deconstruct even your religion or your beliefs, you start to realize that your marriage goes through this metamorphosis and deconstruction as well. And it seems like the more we're willing to reveal to our partners, we can take that and kind of redirect it to show us how we can be more revealing to other people, because it's that ultimate intimacy and connection we have with our spouses that I think kind of teaches us how to shine that outward towards other people. So we start there. I think that's like our main relationship that we start with, that teaches us how we can relate intimately to other people and say, you know, it's okay if I show you my wounds and my scars, because look at where I am right now and I'm still standing. And if we can't at least do that with our spouses, we're never going to be able to do it with other people and other friendships and relationships or with family. So for me, that was just really important. And my husband and I specifically kind of shoved everybody out so we could come back and focus on us and all of like our emotional baggage and everything from the past that we just kind of kept shoving under the rug. And as we did that, we just kind of realized we weren't fully revealing ourselves to each other. And that's why we had so much dysfunction going on with like family relations. And so as we started doing that, it kind of taught us how to respond better to other people, to relate better to other people. And ultimately, I think teaching other people how to do that can help with our disconnection problems in society. So
yeah,
that's what it is for me.
I like it.
Thanks.
Matt, do you have any thoughts?
Well, yeah, I'll just add that I think we go through tremendous growth when we're vulnerable. And yes, it does open us up to being hurt. But that's why I think we also talk about this concept that is called differentiation. And clinical psychologist David Schnarch does a great job fleshing this out, what this means. And I think when we can learn about our true self and know our true self and stand on our own two feet, then when we are able to be vulnerable, when we are able to empty ourselves for the benefit of someone else, to show this agape style love, we're not attaching our self-worth to the reactions that we get from others. So yes, we can get hurt, but as long as we don't attach our self-worth to our ego, to make it plain, I think then we can experience a level of growth and a level of maturity, and marriage will make you grow or it'll fail, typically. And that doesn't mean necessarily divorce. I think there's a lot of failing marriages that continue, and they go on throughout the years. But I think when we're able to balance that, you know, standing on two feet and being vulnerable and giving ourselves, that's when I think we can experience a level of growth that's beyond what we imagined maybe when we first said, I do.
Yeah. Beautiful stuff. Joel says, I love what you, Matt, said about the necessity of safety in the space between people. Have you heard of Imago relationship therapy? If so, will you be incorporating some of the truths in your book? If not, definitely check it out. Have either of you heard of Imago relationship therapy? I have not.
I have not. Have you, Matt?
No, I haven't. But the minute we get off this, I'll probably look it
up. I'll be Googling right now.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Joel. We'll look into that. So awesome. The title Naked and Known, and as you are talking about it, brings me back to the story of Adam and Eve. when they are naked in the garden together and neither one are ashamed.
Yes.
Right. Right. So I'm this like right here at the beginning of the Bible. And one of the things that mimetic theory, Rene Girard, helps me understand is the anthropological truth that the Bible is trying to get at first and foremost. And so this story, I guess, maybe I haven't read your book yet. You haven't finished writing it, but has something to do with where you're going in the book, I would imagine.
Yes. Yes. Matt's sitting there, does it? No. I rewrote that. I actually, we had come to thinking we were set on our sex chapter. And then, I don't know, I was working through some other things and I'm like, no, we're not set. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I started rewriting it. He hasn't even seen it yet. But I told him I was. And I wanted to go back to the Garden of Eden. And I wanted to pinpoint that moment where humanity was okay and comfortable with being naked and feeling no shame, and pulling out that somewhere along the ways we integrated shame into our society. And then we bring that into our marriage. And when we have, even if it doesn't come from a result of anything that happens in our marriage, we bring this emotional baggage in. And I think if we go back to remembering where we started with naked and ashamed, and then we go back and think about how we are as children and babies, you know, that there's no shame in a 2-year-old who wants to go expose themselves to the world because that's what they feel comfortable in. And so, yeah, ultimately it's that, it's going back to that original concept of how do we bring back that original concept of being naked physically as well. I mean, I'm not saying we should start like nudist colonies right now, but physically being naked in front of your spouse is a huge problem for a lot of people. I mean, I can relate. The first few years in my relationship, I had a poor self-image. I did not have a healthy body concept of myself. And I mean, it's just little things like that that can hold us back from truly being naked and known to our spouses. So what I would like to do is try and take off of that whole Eden perspective and see if we can't figure out if we can settle on finding a comfort zone and truly being naked and known, what that can do for our sex lives in a healthy and beneficial way would be superior for many people. Because if you ask me, if we were all having more sex, we'd all be happier.
Okay, let's get to that soon. But before we get to that, one of the things that I was so fascinating about that is that, Adam, when it says that Adam knew his wife, and like when I was in high school, you start knowing that to know someone in Hebrew in the biblical sense, right? So, but it's much more, as you guys are talking about, it's much, knowing on an intimacy level is much more than just about knowing on a sex level. It's a deeper kind of intimacy where there is no shame, there is no accusation. Maybe this is where mimetic theory comes in a little bit more, where there is no, like you can look at someone and not shame them, not accuse them of saying, oh, this isn't quite big enough, or this is too big, or you know, like you can look and you can accept the person for who they are and where they are at this moment in their lives.
Yeah, and I think we need to accept that to be perfect is to accept our imperfections. None of us are, and I think that's where we get into this whole like what is good, what is bad thing. Mm-hmm. You know, going on to the themes in Genesis, like. I think a lot of our problems is labeling good and bad. And then that gives us justification to stand with, you know, the good side instead of the bad side. But then different groups have different definitions. What is good is bad. And then they run into each other and we get into this finger pointing and accusation, this satanic mechanism. Yeah. And I think we do it with ourselves and we do it with our spouses and we do it obviously throughout the world. But I think we do it more subtly than we realize. You know, we're always judging ourselves. We're always looking. I mean, I'm looking at my hair right now and it's not, you know, I'm going to accuse myself.
I have already judged you on your hair.
I know you.
It's already been done.
I've been doing it all week. So,
I'm trying to get used to it. And then I just have to accept myself for who I am.
Yeah. And I have to accept you too. I have to accept your hair. It is, it's got this very handsome wave going on.
Yes, it does.
Oh, God.
Awesome. Mimetic theory hasn't talked a lot about sex. Danielle, I knew I would love this podcast because I knew Danielle would say something like, if we were just having more sex, we'd be happier. And Matt has already brought up Satan, which is fantastic. So how these two fit together is going to be wonderful to talk about. But let's talk about sex and happiness. Let's just go there.
Okay.
You want me to again, don't you? All right. Sex. Okay. So first of all, I want to put a disclaimer. As much as I don't want to, be over anal about the need for monogamy, I will say that from our perspective and what we're writing about, this is about, a committed relationship. So when I talk about sex, I'm talking about sex that's going on between committed people, regardless of, how long you've been together. I just want to put that out there because sometimes I kind of pop off and I'm like, we shouldn't judge people who are out just experimenting and exploring because they're searching for something. They're searching for God. But just so we know from my context. Okay. So as you start to develop a closeness and you start to know someone, I don't think knowing someone just comes in the physical sense. My husband and I knew each other, you know, when we were having sex in the beginning, but we didn't know each other in that we were willing to empty ourselves for one another, that we were willing to not have a democracy within our erotic life, and that it wasn't about what's being equal and what's being perfectly timed and shared and reciprocated evenly. There's a flow that you pick up from one another. I think me and my husband have an essence flow where all throughout the day, there's this push and pull between us, and that kind of helps. That kind of helps keep everything in a flirtatious mode. So when we're connected like that all throughout the day, we're sexually aware of one another, but not so much in like I'm saying like I'm just ready at any moment. When we're keeping that sexuality a part of us, it's creating this flow and this dynamic where. We're erotically connected, and it's not just about being selfless and what's the word I'm looking for? Matt, you can step in anytime because I feel like I'm.
Well, no, I think, well.
I'm going to come back to that.
Yeah, what I'm hearing you saying is that we're going to integrate our sexuality with our spouses or our long-term partners throughout yes. the day. And I got to the place where I think of sex as more than intercourse. Yes. So and like you said, we're not walking around, you know, always being like, I need to have sex right now, but it's being conscious and intentional about, being seductive and pursuing the other sexually, and not for a selfish way, but just to keep those airwaves going. Because I think a lot of times we compartmentalize our lives. Yes. We're doing the children thing here. We're doing the recreational stuff here. We're doing the professional stuff here. And then maybe at the end of the day, after we've watched some TV, we got like 30 minutes or 45 minutes to focus on sex. And it's like, I think good sex is going to require a lot more intentionality and we have to integrate it into our lives. Like we're not a father and then a husband and a writer or a mechanic or whatever we are. We're all those things maybe at once.
Yes. There you go. Thank you for doing that. You brought me back to where I wanted to go with that. Yes. So we have to kind of maintain that what Esther Perel talks about is her erotic intelligence. You need to be aware of your sexuality and you need to keep that fully integrated into who you are. Yes, I'm a mother. But I'm also a sexual being, why I'm a mother. Yes, I have to go milk the cow, but I am also a sexual being, why I'm milking that cow. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it is a sexual experience in what I'm doing. It's just being fully aware of who you are. You are your sexuality. It's not separate from your identity. It is your identity. And so I think just being more aware of that helps significantly with overall body image. I mean, I know it did for me. Sometimes, especially us women, our husbands will tell us we're sexy, we're beautiful, you look great. I wake up right in the morning, you're so beautiful. Okay. You know, and we're like, what is wrong with you? But our husbands are seeing past, or our spouses are kind of seeing past the flaws that we see in ourselves. So I kind of had to get to a point where I was like, he was right. He's seeing what he's seeing. And why am I not seeing that? And I wasn't seeing that is because I was segregating my sexuality. I can't be sexy while I'm making eggs. I can't be sexy while I'm doing math homework with the kids. But then I was like, well, why can't I? Because then I'm only ready to feel sexy, you know, when we're hopping into bed. And then you're like, well, I haven't felt sexy all day. And I'm just not going to just turn it on like a switch like that. You can turn it off like a switch like that. Sure. But you have to be ready to be turned on all day. And so that includes seeing yourself as a sexual being in everything you're doing, and it not being seen as that's the sexual act of you're horny all the time or something. It just means I recognize who I am. I am fully embodied in my sexuality. So
I'm glad you said that last sentence, because I imagine that a lot of people watching this are thinking, man, that sounds like a lot of work because I have to just like be horny all the time.
No.
That's not what you're saying.
No.
What is the difference between being sexy or feeling sexy and being horny all the time?
Being turned on. Well, I would say that I feel like I'm going to take this too far if I get a little vivid with my articulation here. I'm not saying that you should be consciously ready to just be erect at any given moment. I'm saying that you can see yourself as a sexual being. You can see yourself as a sexy person. You can even revere your spouse in noticing how sexy they look driving the tractor or coming home after a long shift at the hospital. You can notice it without it being an impulsive, aggressive need to hurry up and satiate. Because I think if we're just noticing it and then continuing on about what we're doing, we're kind of creating a little flicker of desire in the back. So that when you are ready to come to the point where you want to have intercourse or you want to be more intimate with your spouse, you've already been connected all day because you've already been thinking about it. We get to a point like what Matthew said earlier is we just hop into bed and think, oh, here we go. But we haven't connected at all throughout the day. And even something as subtle as just a touch or a simple kiss can kind of keep that flicker and that spark going a little bit so that it's not all of a sudden flip on that switch. Hurry up. Why aren't you in the mood? What's the matter? And then a lot of women are like, yeah, I haven't been thinking about it all day. Now you just want me to turn it on. It's up to all of us individually to kind of keep that flicker going in the back of our minds and knowing that we don't have to turn it on, but it's ready for us to turn on and it's not going to be as much work. So it's not like you're thinking about images all day and what's going to make me hot. You're just being aware of who you are and what your spouse is doing. And you notice what they're doing and you notice it in a different way. And you're more attentive to that. Oh, I never noticed that. That makes me think of that or how much I appreciate that about her. And I mean, it's not even a sexy act that can turn you on. I mean, my husband's like, I'm going to go do some laundry, honey. And I'm like, okay, thank you. I love that. You know?
Yeah.
And then later I'm like, I'm going to remember that, you know?
I sometimes do the dishes and that's
pretty hot. I mean, you don't need to get all creative with foreplay. I mean, honestly, my husband's like, I'm going to do a couple loads of laundry. And then do you want me to make dinner? And I'm like, yeah, I do.
Yes. I think what I'm appreciating so much about this is that so often you can get caught up in the routine of life, the routine of keeping up a household, and you lose that sense of intimacy, that sense of connection. And I think that's what the sexiness that's how I'm seeing the importance of the sexiness that you're talking about is it's so easy over time to lose the intimacy that you have in a marriage. 7 years in, I guess they say this is like one of the times you're just in the routine of marriage. And how do you keep that intimacy, that sexiness alive is something that I think is really important to talk about. So,
yeah. And it could be as simple as just like a wink and a little text. I mean, just little things that we forget to do in that routine. Like we'll spend so much time balancing checkbooks if we still do that, like we're old school like me, or planning a grocery list and doing all those things. And we're like, oh, well, that's hard work. And yeah, life's hard work. And is it hard work to just send a sexy text or just a brush across the cheek, you know, a wink, just a little compliment here and there. No, that's easy stuff. I mean, yeah. I mean, if we're not doing those things, I think we're like saying that's so difficult, but we do much more difficult things than those little things that we can do. And all of us can do that. We can be more intentional about just little things throughout the day.
Yeah.
We're intentional about checking our notifications on our social media and our phones. But I mean, I notice I get caught up in that sometimes where I'm like, oh, I have all these messages I got to respond. And then I'll go, I'm just going to go tell my husband I miss him and I'll shoot him a text. Yeah. And so it's little things like that, but it's the habit that kills it. The habit kills everything because you get to this point where you're like, I don't have to work that hard. I already got you. I don't have to seduce you. I can just say, yeah, you want to tonight. And you're just supposed to be happy and take it because we have a busy day anyway. And so let's just get this done. And we look at it as just another thing to check off our list. And it's not that. And we have to kind of break up our habits a little bit. What Esther Perel says again about desire is that routine kills it. We get too caught up in just going through the motions that we forget that we need exploration and adventure and discovery and doses of something new to kind of make us think differently. I mean, any new thing we implement into our day is going to change the trajectory of the way we think about everything. We don't realize it, but we know it because when something doesn't go right, we're freaking out. It's chaos. It's panic. What am I going to do? But that same emotion that builds up from that kind of anxious reaction is the same emotion that fuels desire. So it's just, how do you want to redirect it? Do you want to make it overwhelm you, or do you want it to do something else for you later? And so I think that's kind of what we have to do with our routines. We have to break it up every day. You have to just try something. I mean, routine is obviously important too. I'm not going to say just go be sporadic, spontaneous people, but some routine is good. Too much routine is going to kill everything.
Yeah. I think it's shedding our dualism is that comfort. We often think of routine as good and like the opposite side of that is chaos, or comfort is good and uncomfortability is bad. But I think a healthy dose of both is actually beneficial. I think in some instances it's good to be uncomfortable. Like when I first started doing a podcast, it was uncomfortable, or being on like the first time I was much more nervous to be on the Ravencast the first time I came on, because those sort of things were uncomfortable. But without going through that uncomfortability, you don't get to a place where you're growing. And I think we have to go through uncomfortable. Writing is uncomfortable. My first book was really uncomfortable to write. And this one's not so much, just because but you want to still be uncomfortable in certain ways. This is a new topic. I've never written a book like this. So it's
I've never written a book.
So it's uncomfortable in certain ways, but you know, I think it forces us to grow when we can and balance that.
Yeah. Creates excitement. That's what I love. There's a building underneath where it's scary, but it's really exciting, and you want to keep going, and it's kind of tantalizing. And I mean, inject that into your day and see where it gets you.
Yeah,
it's pretty good stuff.
Absolutely. I love it. And also this subject for Christians has been taboo throughout much of our history. And we are seeing the Catholic Church has just had this kind of honesty moment about priests and sexuality. And I think one of the things that I appreciate, I guess what I'm trying to get at is you're bringing this out of the closet in Christian circles and inviting us to have a longer, bigger conversation about our sexuality. And Danielle, how does this fit with Christian theology? How does this fit? When I was talking with Suzanne the other week, you mentioned the self-emptying of Christ.
Kenosis.
And oftentimes we like the Bible is full of sexuality too that we've also repressed. So talk about that a little bit. Not just Danielle, but Matt too.
Yeah, right. Matt's the theologian over here.
Theologian.
That's awesome.
Do you want to?
Yeah, well, I think. I love the idea of kenosis, not only as a Christian theological understanding of who Jesus was, who Christ was in the relation to the Father and his emptying of his own will to do the will of the Father, mm-hmm. I think good theology should be able to be practiced out in real time. And it's not good enough to have all these like sort of ontological, metaphysical, theological claims and then not have anything to do with them. So it's like, well, how can we have imbue kenosis into our sexual relationships? Would that benefit our sexuality and our sexual expression with our partners? And I think it would. And it's almost like a two-way street. When you empty yourself for the benefit of someone else, you actually have gain more pleasure. And without going into details, but if your focus is on feeling and being felt and delivering the most pleasure to your partner, my experience is that it makes for the best sex. So we can have this, and I know it's not like a one-to-one correspondence on this is what kenosis means for sex, but it's just exploring the themes in the Bible and how they could play out in real time. It's like, you have a great day when you're serving others, and it's like we almost get this, like it's cliche, but it's better to give than to receive. And I think when we do give, when we're like ultimate givers, we actually receive more pleasure for ourselves, because the act of sex is not just about your pleasure and my pleasure. It's about the experience itself. And that, so I just found that when you're more of a, how can I please you in, how can I empty myself for you? How can I not be selfish at all in the bedroom? Sex is much, much more, it's much better. It feels better. It's much more connective. It's much more intimate. So I'm always of the belief that our theology, if it's good, should be able to be lived out in real time, and it'll bear good fruit. And if it doesn't bear fruit, it's probably crap theology.
But. Yeah, right. Yes, even good fruit in the bedroom. That's yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And another thing that it's funny is, and this isn't my own discovery, of course, but there's an author by the name of Carol Hauslander who pointed out something called Eucharistic sex. And what she relates sexuality to is, we consider that we have this spiritual relationship with God, and we are to have this spiritual connection with God. But Jesus was very specific about offering his body to us. Take this, this is my body, take it and eat it. This is my body. I'm giving it to you. Why do we always take that and push it aside and not consider that within the sacrament of our marriage, that that is something we should be doing as well? I'm giving you my body. We tell everybody, you don't give your body until you pick the right person, but then we hold back our bodies. And if we're to give all of our heart and we're to give all of our soul and our mind, we're also to give all of our body to one another. And I think it's that act alone where we're creating that kind of like third entity between us, that that connection that we experience together, that's divine, where that way in that we're giving our body kind of helps us mesh all of the components together, and that we can, again, give that outward. It's through kenosis, working with Eros, that teaches us how to share that agape love with everybody. If agape is God's love, this is how we're learning how to do it between people. And not necessarily I'm going to give my body to everybody. I mean, if that's your thing, do it. But that's the one part that we take out. And we can give our body to other people in a non-sexual matter. And that we are always so hesitant to even give a caress or a hug or to be close in physicality with people. But if Christ gave us his body, then I think in turn, we should take that as a symbolic gesture to repeat, to imitate, and to offer our bodies to other, and starting with the person we're in a relationship with.
I like that Eucharistic understanding, because it's it reminds me that the Eucharist is not embedded in an economy of exchange. It's not do this so I get this. It's not I'll do this so you'll do this. That's the sacrificial mindset. And I do, Adam, contrary to what I said earlier, I know a little bit about mimetic theory, but we're always, throughout history, we've been in this sacrificial mindset and in an exchange economy. We do this so that the gods will bless us, right? We make this sacrifice so our crops get some rain, but not too much rain, but the right amount of rain and sun and all that. And I think it's Bob Hamerton Kelly who really points out that the Eucharistic meal is like the complete subversion of that mindset. It's, instead of a broken body and a bloody corpse, we have wine and we have bread, gluten-free bread if you have celiac like me, but bread nonetheless. And I think we can take that non-economy of exchange into our marriage beds. If we're saying, you know, I'll have sex with you if you get the dishes done, that's BS. That's not healthy. That's back in the sacrificial mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, give expecting nothing in return. Right. Yes. This is how you, and he says that, and then he says, and then you will become children of the Most High God. So this is like, this is kenosis. This is all of it. Like, what is God doing in the world? God is giving God's self to what is other. And one of the other theological terms that might be worth exploring in this is the Trinity. Mm-hmm. Because the Trinity is seen, the very first people who talked about the Trinity talked about it with the stupid theological Greek word, perichoresis, right? Mm-hmm. And they ended up talking about it as this interpenetration within the three. So the gods, the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit are like interpenetrating one another, giving everything to the other, expecting nothing in return, and yet receiving everything back in return from the other in this mutual giving and receiving. That's the eros of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we can be very Trinitarian in that way in our daily lives. If we understand the Trinity, if we have a good Trinitarian theology, unlike some of the BS in evangelicalism, but this ever giving flow of love that's always other oriented.
Yeah.
And yeah, that seems to be the most healthy. That's, you know.
And more so with a grace exchange and not so much an economical exchange. I think that should kind of be our focus. I noticed that, you know, in my own marriage, sometimes I think, God, he just keeps giving. He's been working all day. We've been dumped on with snow. And so between tractors jellying up and moving the bobcats around and moving snow, he's so busy. But then he comes in and I'm like, I have to write. And I'm going to do laundry. I'll get dinner done. And I think, why are you so giving? You're so giving all the time. And it's, you start becoming aware of that. If you notice the things your spouse does for you every day and you're like, how do you even have the energy to do this? And when I'm having days going, I'm not adulting. I'm done. Nope. Yeah. You just do it all. Okay, honey, I'll do it all. And I just think, wow, you just keep going. And what that does for me, of course, is I kind of think, okay, well, I think I need to step up my game then, because you're kind of really loving me right now. And I feel like I'm not. And that's that imitation we do with one another, where I'm saying, you're showing me how to be a better person because you're being a really good person right now. And I want to step up to that and I want to match that. And that's a grace exchange. You're kind of transformed by it. You're like in awe of how much your spouse does for you. That now I need to reciprocate it, not because you feel guilty, but because they're showing you what that love looks like. It's endless. It's ongoing. It's self-emptying. And you get to mimic each other in that if you're paying attention. Don't you think there, Matt?
Yeah, of course. That's why when people ask me, is mimesis a bad thing? It's like, no, it's a human thing. When it's non-conscious, it leads to problems, right? Obviously so. But if we're creative, creative mimesis or positive mimesis or imitation, and we're conscious about it, I think it could be a really powerful tool to inspire us, to give us a model. That's why I think the life of Jesus is still so important. As far removed as the religion of Christianity as I sometimes think I am, I still see Jesus as this model of positive imitation. And we can be that model for one another. We have to be really conscious about it and really intentional and really understand grace and not being non-sacrificial in our thinking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. We've got a comment here. I think it's from Lindsay or maybe it's from Maura. It's from the Raven Foundation. She says Lewis Hyde's book, The Gift, Imagination, and the Erotic Life of Property, offers an interesting dissection of societies based on giving or commerce. While he focuses on art and artists, it seems to fit into this conversation. Yeah, I mean, that's going back to the economy of exchange and giving and stuff. So thank you for that. Go ahead.
Oh, you might have to cover that on your podcast, Daniel.
Yeah, I'm thinking about going to Amazon and putting that in my cart right now.
Yeah, right? That's good. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And I'm fascinated by this topic and glad that you are both writing about it and bringing sexuality and Christianity and faith and all of this to life, to light and to life. And, you know, the comment that Danielle made, go have more sex and you'll be happier. It's sticking with me. So, yeah. I don't know if this is worth asking here at the end, but I'm always like the vulnerability aspect is really important, and how to be honest with one another. But there's also like, how do you protect yourself? Like, should we be worried about, like, that's always like my question when I love Brené Brown, and I think she also speaks to this too. Like, there are times when you get burned so much that, how do you protect yourself? Are there times when it's important to put up walls?
Sorry, go ahead, Daniel.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Okay. I think there are times to have seasons of putting up walls. It depends on our life circumstances. And I don't mean that with our spouse, but we do make a caveat in our first chapter that this vulnerability, it could be kind of destructive if you're with a toxic person or if your spouse is not in the same mindset. I am a firm believer that people do not have to believe the same things, to have the same interests, to like the same music, all that stuff. But I think when it comes to this sort of relationship and where vulnerability is put on such an importance is placed on vulnerability or kenosis or wherever we're opening ourselves up for the other person, it only works with a two-way street. Because if the other person is embedded in the economy of exchange, they're just going to be in that mindset. Well, you're doing this so you get that. And it's always going to be sort of cynical. Well, he's just doing the dishes so he'll get a blowjob later or something. can I say that on here? But if one person is stuck in that mindset, and we all live in that mindset sometimes, you know, we can't. It's part of our almost like it, we're drawn to it as human beings. But as long as we're moving away from that, I think we have to move away from that together. And because there is risk when you're vulnerable and someone else is abusive or I mean, I would never say, yeah, continue to be vulnerable and continue to pour out yourself to an abusive spouse. Like, no, that's not, or not even an abusive spouse. You don't have to go so far, but someone who is taking and taking and taking and never giving, it seems like it only works if both people could try or attempt to shed that economic model.
Yeah. And I would add that, even in taking the first steps to become more vulnerable, it is such a long drawn out process. It's not something that you should expect to see immediate results. And it is scary. It's a big risk. You're telling somebody stuff that you've thought you've never would be able to share with them. And so just like marriage itself is just this process of evolving and shifting into different seasons and cycles, becoming more vulnerable is going to also be more of a process. And it's sure you can just say, here's all the emotional baggage and dump it on the table. Let's sort through it. But it's easier to just kind of start with little pieces at a time. And that will help you gauge each other to see how much each of you are willing to handle and how each of you are able to process it, because we all process things differently and we have to reflect upon everything we share. We shouldn't come to immediate decisions, but the number one rule, even in this, is you can't shame each other. You love each other. So if you want it to work and if you want to see growth and breakthrough, you have to take shame out of the equation altogether. You have to, even if that means you have to learn how to control your facial expressions so that you're not going to harm your partner in taking this courageous leap and revealing something that deep. Just shame's off the table, nothing but non-judgment. And if we're following the teachings of Christ, we're not going to judge our spouse anyway. Hopefully not.
Beautiful. Awesome. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you so much for this conversation. And when the book comes out, I would love to bring you back on and talk about what's in the book. So that'd be fantastic. Danielle, if people want to keep up with you, how can they do that?
You can find me on Facebook, Danielle Kingstrom. We will Bookish drops next week, so you can catch that on Podbean and iTunes. It's Bookish, The Canon Continues. So as soon as we launch that intro, you can hurry up and subscribe, or you can check out bookish.cc for more information on that as well.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Matt, how can people keep up with you?
Like Danielle, on Facebook is where I have Twitter and Instagram and stuff, but mainly I'm on Facebook, so you can follow me on there. Send me a friend request. The Heretic Happy Hour, heretichappyhour.com/ There's no slash. So that's the podcast website. And I have a Pathios blog, although I haven't been writing on there. So, it's pathios.com/blog/allsetfree. That's the name of my blog, or you could just Google that. So
awesome. Fantastic. Thank you for both for being here and having this important and provocative and fun conversation about sex and faith and intimacy. And I'm looking forward to the book. And thank you, everybody, for joining us and for your comments and questions. I missed Kevin Miller's. I should add this. Kevin Miller says that he was looking at my tattoo, which is awfully sexy.
Did you show a close up of that?
Just like this with my arms and stuff. And so Kevin was like, "Hey, I'm looking at Adam's tattoo. Here it is. It's there you go." So thank you for the shout out, Kevin. It's Jesus bringing people out of hell. So it's like, you know, sometimes Jesus has to come and drag us out of hell. And there's this 11th century icon where Jesus is dragging Adam, me, I guess, out of hell. Adam. And sometimes I need that. And so that's what that's about. So anyway, I love it so much. I got it tattooed on my arm.
Yeah, so it is sexy. It is sexy.
It's sexy. Yes, yes. Thank you very much. So you can keep up with all things Raven Foundation at the Raven Foundation Facebook page, and you can check out the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org. Thank you again for being here. And until next time, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.